So then welcome again to our Dhamma talk today in the evening. So the topic is gaining freedom, and it's the last of my three Dhamma talks in Olamara. So the Buddha said once, all I teach is suffering and the end of suffering, showing our present situation. So he pointed out what leads to suffering, also what leads to the end of suffering, and also he showed the path leading out of our suffering. Many take this, non-Buddhists who hear this the first time, they say the Buddha is always talking about suffering, it sounds so negative, but actually it is very realistic, just showing our situation and also showing the path leading to the end of suffering. So why is there so much suffering in our world? The main reason is because many people who are in charge of our society are not really spiritual, or they do not use the natural law, they do not use tools like meditation to calm their mind. So worldly-minded, busy-minded people who are in charge of our global society. So if we would put in more spiritual people, definitely our society would go into another direction. Often the root, the root cause of all suffering is what is called micchaditti, or wrong view. The best example for somebody who has this wrong view or micchaditti is of course Devadatta. He was one of the monks living with the Buddha. Not only that, he was even a relative of the Buddha, so he was his cousin. He grew up together with the Buddha. Later he had faith enough to ordain under the Buddha. He even made some progress in Samatha meditation, so he was a gifted meditator. But then later, because he developed jealousy against the Buddha, he not only once but three times tried to kill the Buddha. Like we see here in this picture, once he tried to, he rolled down a rock trying to kill the Buddha, which was not successful. But he created a huge amount of bad karma, which made it impossible for him to make real progress later in meditation. So micchaditti is often also called the biggest sickness in our world. So somebody who has a wrong view, a wrong idea about what is good, what is bad, it is very difficult to help such a person. But even if we see all these negative things in our society, we should not lose faith in humanity. Humanity, according to Mahatma Gandhi, humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not become dirty. So the majority of the people out there are good. They are interested in making spiritual progress. They try to live a good life. Often the how is different. Also many have a different understanding what leads to happiness. But often the majority of the people have good intentions. Also when it comes to religion, every religion contains a little bit of dharma. Madame Blavatsky said this, there is no religion higher than the truth, or I would say higher than the Dhamma. So the Dhamma is standing above all religions, and each religion contains a little bit of this Dhamma. All these Indian yoga and meditation systems have been made to unlock the energies in your body and mind, to clean your subconsciousness from all the negative emotions, negative energies, to free your mind and to gain higher stages of consciousness. Also wisdom, the Buddha was called the one who had the ultimate wisdom. Wisdom is threefold, so there are three parts in gaining wisdom. Number one is received wisdom. So if you read a book, or you listen to a Dhamma talk, or you hear some wisdom somewhere, it is a received wisdom. So you heard it somewhere or you read it somewhere. Second one is the intellectual wisdom. So you use your intellect, you reason about what you have read in a book, you try to understand it intellectually, which leads to a higher form of wisdom. And the last one, the experiential wisdom, is the one you gain from direct experience, like in meditation. In meditation, you understand everything is impermanent, non-self, or non-satisfactory. So you get a deeper understanding on an experiential level, and this is the wisdom which you cannot lose anymore. So what we usually understand in our meditation is anicca, which is translated as impermanent or impermanency. Impermanent, all things arise and they arise and pass away from moment to moment. So if you watch your mind in meditation, that's usually the first thing you see in your meditation. Everything is changing from moment to moment. The second understanding is dukkha, or sometimes translated as suffering or non-satisfactory. So if something is changing from moment to moment and you cannot control it, then it is also non-satisfactory. The last one of these three, anatta, means the non-self nature of your body and mind. Now everybody can see that this, our body is not, we cannot control it. The Buddha said if the body would be yours, you could say, I want to look like this, I want to live healthily or up to a certain age. But because you cannot control your body, it is anatta, or not self. Even easier it is to see that your mind is anatta, especially for a meditator. So if you sit down in meditation, you will see the mind is changing from moment to moment. You can also try to sit down and let's say you say for 5 minutes I want to sit here and not to think anything. You will not be able to do that. Or let's say you sit down and say for 5 minutes I want to think only nice positive thoughts. Again, you have no control of which thoughts come up and at which moment. So anatta means the non-self nature of your body and mind. Usually also when we, coming back now to this wisdom, so we said the first part of wisdom is called Sutta-Maya-Banya, or is the learned wisdom. So we read it somewhere, we heard it somewhere, it is received or borrowed wisdom. This wisdom we can, we study it, we learn it, we memorize it. Later, for a while we might remember it, but we can lose this memory later again. So at a later stage we might forget about it or we can't remember it anymore. The second, as we said, it's in Pali, it's called Chintamaya Banya. It is already a deeper understanding, so intellectually I understand completely what I have read or what I have heard. But still, even this knowledge can be lost at a later stage. I can forget about it, or it may change. So I read something else, I intellectually understand something differently. So I may change my idea or I may forget about it. One side effect of this second wisdom is arrogance. So sometimes if I'm too intellectual and I think I know everything perfectly, I am the best. So it can lead as a side effect to arrogance, which again is a big hindrance for meditation. The third one, as you said, in Pali it's called Bhavanamaya-Banya. This is the wisdom you gain through direct experience in your meditation. This is the real wisdom. Received wisdom and intellectual understanding are very useful, but if it does not lead to this third type of wisdom, it is not permanent and it cannot change our consciousness. So from all these three, the last one is the one we are going after. So Bhavana Maya Banya, direct experience, direct understanding or wisdom in our meditation is the one we are trying to get in our meditation. The simile the Buddha gave is like somebody going to a doctor because of some sickness. The doctor gives you some medicine, some tablets. The first wisdom would be like somebody who gets that prescription from the doctor. He goes home and every day he recites the description. Then after a while he finds out it does not cure him, so he goes back to the doctor. He demands some explanation. So he says, here's the prescription, what does that mean? So the doctor explains, okay, this is your sickness, this is the medicine, this is what you have to do. Again, he goes home without taking the medicine. He is happy that he understands the prescription. Then the third one, again, it does not cure him, so he comes back to the doctor again and he says, you have to take the tablets. So finally, he takes the medicine, he cures the sickness, and he gets well again. So this he gave as a simile of these three types of wisdom. So the last one, actually taking the medicine and curing the sickness, is like the wisdom you get in your meditation. So taking the medicine is like the experiential wisdom, the wisdom we get in our meditation. Again, during our lifetime, there are only two things we can accumulate which cannot get lost anymore. So even if you die and you are reborn at a different place, two things are always going with you. One is good karma, so all the good things you do during your life, all the good deeds you will take into your next life. And the second one is this experiential wisdom or real progress in your meditation. So experience in your meditation, experiential wisdom, also goes with you from life to life and cannot be lost again. Also, if somebody makes real progress in meditation and reaches stages of awakening, if you are reborn again, a small child cannot remember that it is developed in meditation. But as soon as that child starts with meditation again, immediately this past experience is coming up, and then these are the cases where they make very quick progress in meditation. That means there was an experience from the past and it resurfaced in the meditation. So Buddha's knowledge was based on experience. Everything the Buddha taught in his Buddhist teaching in the Dhamma was based on his own personal experience. And there were some occasions where people came and asked some theoretical questions where the Buddha actually said, I don't know, I have not experienced that. So he never claimed that he knows everything what is written in all the books or all the theoretical knowledge. What he was teaching, what he was talking about was his experiential wisdom. So what he has experienced in his meditation, also the path or the meditation technique he gave, was all based on his own experience. So we usually understand in this Vipassana meditation, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanence, the not-self nature, and the non-satisfactory nature. Once experienced in meditation, also during the day, you can see the impermanence everywhere. You see everything with different eyes, so what they call the eyes are open. You see you are half awake. You see reality as it actually is. Unfortunately, nobody can be told what the truth is, or the Buddha was often asked, what is enlightenment? The Buddha says nobody can be told what enlightenment is. There's only way to find out is sit down, meditate, and experience it for yourself. Also, Nibbana or enlightenment cannot really be put into words. It is beyond words, it is pure experience. So you have to be there in order to understand it completely. What's about the law of karma or the natural law? We talked before about it. many believe that the truth is subjective, so we can change it according to our situation. But according to the Buddha, the law is written in stone, so the truth is eternal and it never changes. So the truth never changes, but our perception about the truth may change from moment to moment. And usually people like to twist things around, or they say, yeah, in my certain situation it must be different. But the truth is, it never changes, it is written in stone. All we can do is to understand this natural law, to live our life accordingly, and also then to get the benefit of it. So in order to attain the goal, we have to work hard in our meditation, we have to practice daily to calm our mind, to observe all the reactions in our mind. In meditation, there are two things we need. One is mindfulness, so you have to be fully mindful of whatever is going on in your body and mind, and you have to be fully equanimous. So whenever something arises in your mind, or let's say you feel pain in your legs, it is important not to analyze it as I like it or I don't like it. I have to stop it with an equanimous thought. So I just note it as a sensation and I move on with my meditation. Whenever I allow the mind to analyze it as pleasant or unpleasant, I create a new karmic energy which at a later occasion will come back as a memory. Another reason why the human behavior is sometimes so strange is that we have not one but three brains. A study has been done about that. It says the human being has three brains which are incompatible, and also they try to work together, often they fail. And according to this study, we have the human brain is built up in three layers. So the lowest one is called the R complex, the limbic system, and the neocortex. And each one has a different function in our body. The lowest one the lowest one is also called the reptilian brain. It mainly has to do with survival and fear. So whenever you are in a mode of fear or panic, that lower brain is taking over. The second one, the mammal brain, is the emotional seeking pleasure brain. Usually there it's all about feelings, how you feel, how you perceive things. And the highest one, the rational brain, the neocortex, has to do with logic and thinking. Now often these three, usually they work together, but in, let's say, in situations of panic or fear, the brain number one and two is basically, two and three, basically switched off, and the lowest brain is taking over. So according to this study, it has been said that many people mostly use brain 1 and 2 and rarely trouble the highest brain. So as it should be, usually the highest brain should control all the lower ones. Often it is the other way around. If not the lowest brain, then the second brain, it has all to do with emotions. So the emotions hijack our higher brain functions. So it is like, we can compare it like a small reptile sitting in our brain, dictating our life. And especially our society also is structured in a way that to keep people in a fear mode or a panic mode, this problem and that problem. So as long as somebody is afraid, the lowest brain is controlling your life. Importantly is, in meditation we develop the highest layer, and the highest brain is starting controlling the lower ones. So usually all these impulses from the five senses lead to more and more suffering or problems in our life because we do not stop it with a neutral sensation. So whenever impulses come into our mind, we start to analyze, this I like, this I don't like. So we grasp certain things and reject the other things. So sensations usually lead to misery, but only because we do not know how to handle these sensations. So if somebody is experienced in Vipassana meditation, he knows how to note everything with a neutral thought, how to let go things, and how to find peace and happiness in his life. The other thing which, so just be aware of all the sensations. If you are sitting meditation or if you watch your mind, the workings of your mind, if you just let it happen, you are fully aware in this present moment, you will reach a different level of living, or what they call the art of living. Often also it is that people expect things in their meditation, so often things happen in the meditation, nice things, special experiences, and then often we try to re-experience the same thing over and over again. There's one story of one monk in Sri Lanka, his name was Nyanasanda. He when he started with meditation, he had a very nice experience one day. He was sitting in his meditation hut. He was meditating for 1 hour. After 1 hour, he thought, so now it's enough with meditation. So he got up, walked out of his hut and opened the door, walked out of it. When he looked back inside the hut, he could see that he was still sitting inside the meditation hut. So actually, only his astral body got up, walked out of the room, and when he looked through the door, he could see he was still sitting inside. So in that moment, he was so shocked to see himself sitting inside that immediately he was reconnected and he was sitting there again. So he said it was a very wonderful experience, and the next 10 years, he tried to do that again, and it never happened. So for 10 years he tried to get this nice experience back again, and it never happened again. And the reason why it never happened is because he expected it so much. So if he would just have continued his normal meditation without expecting anything, maybe this experience would have happened many, many times again. So usually if we meditate, many nice things are happening, we get many new experiences, but never expect anything back, to relive experience, or also not to expect anything in the future. It will happen automatically. So the less you expect, the more equanimous you are, the quicker you will get many, many nice experiences. So in meditation, remain equanimous, watching the sensations. Now, especially in this Vipassana meditation, the most important thing is equanimity. So whatever comes up, pleasant or painful, nice or not nice, interesting or not interesting, just watch whatever is there. Don't expect anything, and also do not try to change the experience. So if you work in this way, gradually the entire law of nature will become clear to you. This is what Dhamma means. Dhamma literally translated means nature, law or truth. So to understand truth at the experiential level, one must investigate the workings of your mind. So if you watch your mind, watch what your consciousness is doing, little by little, the whole law of nature will become clear to you. And this is exactly what Prince Siddhartha did and which made him into a Buddha. So he never claimed to be a god or somebody special. He said he is reborn as a human being like you and me. Only through his own observation, through his own meditation, he became into a Buddha. And the Buddha is not a name, it's a title, it just means the enlightened one. And coming back to the karma, so if we do something, even think something or say something, we should be very careful what we put out into the universe. So if we plant a seed of karma, we should be very mindful which seed we are planting. Now in Asian countries we get a lot of mango trees, and there's another tree called the neem tree, which is very bitter. The fruits are very bitter. So many people like to have sweet mangoes, but when they plant the seeds, they're very careless. So they plant neem trees and expecting sweet mangoes. So karma is similar. Whatever we put out there into the universe, good or bad, it is coming back the same way. So if you plant sweet seeds of mangoes, what you get is sweet, sweet karma. If you plant a lot of neem trees, what you get back is very bitter fruits of karma. Another important point in getting a handle of how karma is working is to understand the workings of your mind. So they say the understanding about karma is twofold. One is the understanding of how your mind is working, and the other one is how the law of karma is working. Understanding this law of nature very well, you can adjust your life accordingly and attract a lot of good things, a lot of happiness into your life. In meditation itself, importantly, neither to be elated nor attached, just watch with equanimity. So during our waking state, when we are out there, we can purposely do good things in order to attract good karma. In meditation, we should not even do that. So we should not even analyze it as nice or bad. Just be equanimous. So in meditation, these four things are usually said are necessary for making progress in your meditation. First is the effort. It depends on how much effort you put into it. It depends on how much time you spend in your meditation. Also, it is important the technique, that you have a meditation technique which is actually working, using one which has been proven to be successful or working. So if you use a meditation technique where thousands of people have already made progress with it, then you can be fairly sure that the system is working. Then it depends only on you personally, how much time and effort you put into it. The last one, Bharami, means your experience from the past. We never know how much experience there is, but as mentioned before, the only way to find out is sit down, meditate. If you make very quick progress, that means there was a lot of experience from the past. If it takes longer or the progress is slow, there's less paramis from the past. But I think everybody who actually sits down and tries to meditate, there is already some experience. Without any experience from the past, you would not even think of sitting down and meditating. The nice thing is, if you really make progress in your meditations or having experienced stages of awakening, one is unable to do anything wrong or immoral. So before that, we have precepts, we have rules, or we try to stick to a good behavior. Sometimes we may fail, sometimes we are successful. But after making real progress in meditation, it becomes impossible to do anything wrong. So even if there would be a situation where I could lie in order to save, to help somebody else, it's not possible anymore. I just can't do it. It's not that energy to do wrong things is no longer there. A good example what they always give is this one. They say, it's often called a moral dilemma. So let's say you walk through a forest. There comes a junction, one road to the right, the other to the left. A small boy comes running and runs down the right road. Shortly after that, five robbers with swords come running and say, "Where's the boy? We want to kill him." So what do you say? You can either say he went the right way, then they might go and kill him. Or you can lie and say he went the left road, then the boy may be safe, but you lied and you know it's not right. So what should you do? Often in these situations it is not completely clear what we should do. It's like a gray area. So we could of course lie and save the boy, which would be less bad karma. But the perfect solution would be I remain silent. So I don't say anything and then the robbers might kill you. So, but somebody who is really enlightened or is very far would not mind anything what happens to him. He would just ignore them and keep on walking and not worried what happens to him. So sometimes with karma we cannot, whatever we do is little bit of this and that karma. Often we have to remain silent or not do anything. So, but again, back if somebody would be really developed, he would not be able to lie even for the sake of the boy. So the only thing he could do is remain silent. Okay, then another, what the Buddha called the five friends of meditation. These are again not necessary things, but the Buddha said these things are very useful for meditation. So the first one is faith. Satta is the Pali word, often translated as faith, but again it's faith based on experience. Second one is effort, the third one awareness or mindfulness, four is concentration, and the last one is wisdom. So this satta or faith, as we said, in Buddhism there is no blind faith. The only faith mentioned here is based on experience. So let's say you meditate for 3 months doing a certain type of meditation. After 3 months you feel this meditation is really helping me. I'm much more calm now, I get less angry, I feel much better about myself. So you develop faith in your meditation based on experience. So this type of faith. Then also in Buddhism there are two important things. One is we should always preach what we practice. So if you go anywhere to a teacher and he tells you things to do, but he's doing something differently, ignore him. The second one is no double standards. So if you teach something, this is good, it is good for everyone. There are no different standards, like saying the chief monk he can do different, the others have to do it this way. There are no differences. So if it's the truth, if it is the Dhamma, it is applied to everyone the same way. And what we preach, we should also practice. So the second one of these noble friends is virya or effort. It means to make the effort even to sit down and meditate. In meditation you make an effort to keep the negative things down and develop the good things. This is the fourth one. The third one is sati or awareness. So the most important one in your meditation. Without awareness or mindfulness, you will not be able to keep the mind on your meditation object. You will not be able to do this vipassana meditation. The next one, samatha or concentration. So usually that's why we use one main object in meditation. There's another, like I think in the Zen meditation, they don't have a main object. They just watch the mind or whatever is going on in the mind. It's also possible, but more difficult to get into it. In this vipassana meditation, we use the breath as the main object. So we focus the mind, to concentrate the mind on the breath. Whenever the mind wanders away, we note it and bring it back again. So the main focus point is the breath in this meditation. And the last one, panya or wisdom, we had already before. So you need already a little bit of wisdom even to sit down in meditation, and in meditation you develop deeper into wisdom. And it is all experiential wisdom, or Bhavanamaya-Banya. So it is the real wisdom, what the Buddha called experiential wisdom, really your own wisdom. So it's not the wisdom of somebody else who wrote it in a book, or not even your intellectual wisdom, it is real experiential wisdom. So vipassana, leading to peace and happiness, so all the practice of vipassana is the challenge to turn your life from trouble into peace and happiness. So it is often also called the art of living, or you reach a different level of practicing your life. You will find that all your difficulties are going down. Often also if there are problems in your life, it's not useful to think directly about that particular problem. Often a problem cannot be solved on the same level where we created it. So often it's good to keep the problem just in the room, sit down, calm your mind and meditate. After the meditation, if you think about the problem, often it happens that the problem is solved automatically. There's one story in India. There used to be a famous yogi called Ramana Maharshi in South India. I have been once to his ashram. And it is said that once a very important politician from India came flying in to visit him. He came running into the monastery saying, "Where's the yogi? I have a problem. I have to ask him something." And he was told that the yogi is sitting in meditation in the moment, but he can sit down there, meditate with him. After the meditation is over, he can ask his question. So he was sitting down there, meditating for 1 hour. The yogi didn't even open his eyes. After 1 hour, the important person got up and said, "Thank you, and I'm going now." And they said, "What's about your problem? You didn't ask anything." And they said, it's fine, it's okay, it's all clear." So he got it, he calmed the mind, the problem was solved automatically. And there were many such stories about that Ramana Maharshi. Another important thing, also Buddhism is has worldwide a very good name because it's very tolerant. So Buddhism is usually known for being very tolerant with other traditions also. Also Dalai Lama is the best example for that. So he is worldwide very respected because he has very tolerant views. So as long as we see differences in other people, usually Buddhists do not go out and try to change their opinions. We respect others. Also the only conversion in Buddhism is from misery to happiness. So we do not go out and try to change the opinions of others. Everybody who lives a good human life is a good human being. Doesn't matter what he or himself, what they call themselves. So the only conversion which we know in meditation is from misery to happiness. So these five friends, try to keep them close and strong. They are very helpful in your meditation. So in Satta, this faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So if you want to be a Dharma warrior, first of all, you have to meditate and calm your own mind. Later, go out and help the others also to find the path to enlightenment. The important thing in this Buddhist practice is to free yourself from your mind. That means, usually if we talk about the mind, they think we are the mind. Then if we meditate, we realize there are actually two things in your mind. One is the running mind, it runs with the five senses. And the other thing is the wisdom which can watch the mind. And in meditation we create a gap between the two, so you can actually watch what your mind is doing. And also you can you get a freedom again. You need not to do what the mind is asking for. So the mind will be asking, I want this, I want that, let's go do this and that. The wisdom can watch it, and also the wisdom can control it. So if the mind is asking for something, and you can analyze it, you can say, okay, mind is asking for this, is that useful, is that necessary, should I do this? And if not, the wisdom has the power to say, no, that's not necessary, you just note it and let it go. Somebody is not meditating, he believes he is the mind, so whatever the mind is asking for, basically he has to do it. So he is a slave to his own mind, he has no freedom and no control. And often when we hear about nowadays in Europe and America, people raping people on the street and so on, often these people are victims to their own mind. So the mind is asking for these kind of things, they have no control and they have to go along with it. So often we can regard these people not as criminals but as sick people, or at least people out of control. So in meditation you get control back, you get a handle of your mind and you have a choice again. So what the Buddha basically was saying, he never claimed to be some messiah or somebody special. He said, if you want freedom, just follow me. Even after the Buddha attained enlightenment under the tree, in the beginning he was not even sure if he should teach it, because he said, this teaching is very deep, very difficult to understand. If I go out and teach this Dhamma, I might have a lot of troubles. So why not just sit here and enjoy my meditation? After he looked again, he saw that there are some people out there who could understand this teaching, but he knew it will be just a few, so he did not go out with the intention to save everyone, because he knew it's impossible. According to our karmical evolution, everybody is on a different level, so only these few people who are on the highest level, they have the understanding, they can grasp the teaching. So then he said, okay, I'm ready to teach it. Whoever has little dust in their eyes, I will teach them. All the others might not understand it. So with this intention, he went off and he started teaching the Buddhist teaching, the Dhamma. And as we know, many, many thousands of people followed him, became even monks and nuns. And this movement of the Buddha was so successful that even nowadays we have his teaching. But at any given time, there will be only a few people, the minority of the people, who can understand this teaching, and especially who are ready for meditation and can really make some progress in meditation. So the choice and freedom to evolve is with us. So we have freedom of choice. We can do whatever we feel is the right thing in our life, especially living in a country like Australia. You have a very good karma. You have the opportunity to use this teaching for your benefit, to calm your mind, to develop higher stages of consciousness, and to free your mind from all the defilements. So free your mind, use this rare opportunity, free your mind, also help others on the way to meditation, on the way to enlightenment. So with that, I come to the end of this short Dhamma talk. I hope that all of you will be continuing on the Dhamma path, continue with your meditation, and may you all be able to free your mind from all the defilements and reach stages of awakening. Sadhu, sadhu. So at the end we have I have a short chanting just to share the merit. Sabitiyo vivacchantu sapparogo vinassatu mami pavatvantarayo sukidigayuko bhava. Bhavattu sappa mangalang rakkantu sappa devata Sappabuddhanupavena sada sutti bhavantu ti. Abhivadana silissa nichyam vattabhacayino. Chattaro dhamma vadanti ayuvarna sukhang balam. Ayura rogya sambatti sakka sambatti mevacha. Atto nippana sambatti iminadi samichatu. Satsana. So this is again my monastery in Sri Lanka. So everybody who maybe comes sometimes for holiday to Sri Lanka, you're welcome to visit us. It's on the southeast coast of Sri Lanka. It's a very secluded area. The monastery is near the beach, so often people come there for meditation. So you're welcome to visit us. Place is called Sastravela. And it's a small monk's school, so it's a Buddhist school where we teach the children Buddhism and meditation. It's, as I said, near the beach. The closest village is called Panama, like the country Panama. There are lots of wild elephants around, so in the evening you have to be careful. Usually they sleep during the day. After 5 o'clock they come out. So they walk around at night, not during the day. And it's an ancient place, so there are small like caves and kutis for meditation around. This is the evening chanting. And this is my kuti where I usually stay for meditation. So anybody who is interested, my email is there somewhere on this one. When you happen to come to Sri Lanka, send me an email and I can show around you in that area. Okay, with that we come to the end. If there are any questions, we can do a short question and answer. Otherwise, we stop for today. Are there any questions? Yeah, behind her. I think we have a mic somewhere. You have to switch it on.
Hello. Thank you for tonight. It's always very interesting, and your meditations are very, very beautiful. Just a very short question. Are there any girls that are being trained, or is it all just boys, monks?
At our place, because in Sri Lanka you get to do different types of education. One are the government schools, and the second is the monks' schools. The monks' schools are only for boys. The government schools are for boys and girls. But all this, it's called Birivena education in Sri Lanka, and so because the monks are doing it, and they are like boarding schools, so the boys are living there in the temple. And because they live together with the monks, it's only boys, girls would not be suitable. But there are like nunneries in Sri Lanka, and I don't know if they have schools, but like females are going there for meditation. Yeah. But we don't have anything against girls. So.
So if we were to visit, it's okay for women to come and stay there?
There are certain monasteries where they have facilities for male and female. Certain very secluded monasteries, they are only for males. Or there are nunneries where the females are going. But there are special meditation centers where they have facilities for both, no? So they both can stay here.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. You can take the mic.
You mentioned five senses in your talk. What happened to it?
Which one did I forget?
Well, you just mentioned five senses. So
Usually I say five. Huh? No, usually I say five senses plus the mind. Usually they mention all the five and they mention the mind extra, but there are six, yeah. with the mind is six. Yeah. So all the five external senses and the mind as the sixth. And if you sit in meditation, because all the external senses, they are more or less closed. So you sit at a quiet place, eyes are closed, you sit, you don't move around. So usually you get much less sensations from the five senses. And then what happens, more and more it comes out from inside. So all the memories start flowing out, and you try to be equanimous, so you note it equanimously and let the memory go. So as long as you don't grasp these memories, you clean out all the memories from your subconsciousness. So they say this is one way of cleaning out all the karma from your subconscious mind. So you sit in meditation mindfully and don't react. So whatever comes up, just note it, it's there, and let it go. And then you will note, when you do the meditation for a while, that first usually very heavy memory is coming, so your biggest traumas or something very serious from your childhood or whatever. After that is gone, small memories come. And sometimes if you meditate, very small things, like things you have long forgotten, unimportant small memories from your childhood, suddenly comes up and you relive that moment. Again, if you remain equanimous, it just goes away and it never comes back again. If you grasp this memory, or let's say you remember you beat up another boy in school, and so you can react in two ways. Either you say, yeah, he deserved it, I should have beaten him some more. It's bad karma, so it's a bad memory, it goes back in again as a memory. Or you can say, I shouldn't have done that, I'm so sorry, that's good karma. But again, it's a memory, it goes back in again. In meditation, the wisest thing is, if this memory comes up, I just note it as a memory. I say, okay, it's just a memory, and let it go. I do not analyze it was good or bad, or I like it or don't like it. It's just a memory, I let it pass away, and then usually that memory is not coming again. So it's cleaned out, it's gone. So I'm free from that karmical energy, from that memory, and I cleaned it out from my subconsciousness. But yeah, there are six, not five. Thank you. Yeah?
Just in regards to karma, for example, if I say had really negative thoughts and I swore, and I knew that's bad karma, how, if I apologize, mm-hmm. Yeah. And can I take it back so that karma is taken back?
They say karma is like posting a picture on Facebook. You can never take it back. It's out there. So some people, if they post something on Facebook and later they're sorry, I shouldn't have put on this picture. What you can't take it back. It's out. It's gone. No? And somebody may have saved it somewhere. What you can do then, you put out 100 other pictures in order to cover it up. And then maybe you can hope they don't find it. So karma, similar, you can do similar things. So if you do a karma, you can't take it back. But let's say I've done something which was not, later I remember it was not good. I can do a lot of good karma in order to cover it up. I balance it out. That's the only thing I can do. I cannot take you back. But if you say, I'm sorry, or you reflect on it, or that was not good, I will not do that again, then also the karma is getting less strong, but it's still there, it's out there. Yeah, it's a very good question. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay, then I think we stop for today. So thanks everybody for coming. Enjoyed the time with you. Most probably next year we'll come again for a visit. So thanks everybody and have a very nice day. Special thanks to Mr. Premalal who brought me here, to Mr. Yu and Mrs. Lucky who is not here today. Also all the other people who helped me here in Nola Mara. So thanks a lot and I'm hoping to come next year again. So. Thank you.
Sadhu. Sadhu. So, Ajahn, thank you very much for your presence here this last three Fridays. I really appreciate, on behalf of everyone here, to thank you very much for being here and to give us these illustrated talks, which are very helpful. And I wish you all the best for the remaining part of your stay here in Australia. And we do, if you're able to come next year, that would be great about this time.